Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. And I hope it'll be, for you, a very, very special afternoon. Special because you're a special audience. Special because we're part of, I think, an extraordinary Brighton Festival with a very challenging theme. And I think as Lord Briggs speaks this afternoon, you will see how well the topics that he's going to talk about fit with the theme of dictatorship, conflict, conflict resolution. And special finally because we are in the company of an extraordinary man. Asa Briggs was the second Vice Chancellor of the University of Sussex. I am privileged to have followed him 40 years later to the year as its seventh Vice Chancellor. He's a very special man because he's had a huge breadth in his life and has contributed to an enormous number of different universities, different ideas to his discipline of history, and on a much wider scale to higher education in general. But he'll talk today about a very specific and really quite a short period of his life, but I think you'll see from my earlier remarks that the repercussions of that go much, much wider. Lord Briggs was born on the 7th of May 1921, which you don't have to have a PhD in mathematics to realise that he celebrated his 90th birthday just about 2 weeks ago. He's had three birthday parties, the last of which, last of which I'm aware of, was on Monday, where we had a fantastic celebration for him at the university. He hasn't stopped in the last 2 weeks. He's been at Bletchley Park launching this book. He was at the Historical Research Society on Thursday. And fortunate enough, he's with us today. He was born in Keighley in Yorkshire, went to a grammar school, was the first member of his family to go to a university, went to Sydney Sussex, the University of Cambridge. Simultaneously took an external degree at the University of London and ended up with two bachelor's degrees at the end of that period, and then was recruited into the intelligence corps. We were then in the early 1940s, and that's where he'll tell you about. But just to fast forward, he has had the most stellar career since then. He went to Leeds. Immediately after the war, he went to Worcester College, Oxford, as a fellow. He then went to Leeds as Professor of History, but came to Sussex and was one of the founding fathers of the University of Sussex in 1961, to be Vice-Chancellor in 1967, and then to move on back to Worcester College, Oxford, as Provost in 1976. He's been Chancellor of the Open University, and now remains as active as ever. And if you think it's extraordinary that a man approaching his 90th birthday should have delivered what indeed is a remarkable book, if I tell you that he's planning to deliver another book this year in September, as he tells me, along a parallel theme, but it will be about some special relationships and reflections that he has looking back over his life. Just to so that you know what we're going to do, Lord Briggs is now going to give you an introduction to his book. We will then have an opportunity to ask him questions. I may take chairman's prerogative and ask him one or two at the start, but it's very much a conversation with you. And then at the end of that, Lord Briggs will leave. And I'd ask you all just to remain seated while Lord Briggs leaves the auditorium so that we can get him in position for book signing at the end of the afternoon. So it is with great, great pleasure that I introduce to you Lord Briggs.
Thank you. It is a very great pleasure indeed to be with you this afternoon. I never thought that I would be ever writing a book about Bletchley. For a long time, everything had to be kept totally secret. My mother and father didn't know what I was doing during the war when I was at Bletchley. They did know that I was at Bletchley. They were allowed to send letters with Bletchley as part of the address. When I married my wife in 1955, I couldn't talk to her about anything that I'd done during the war. Indeed, it wasn't until the 1970s and 80s that the story of Bletchley began to be opened up. And it was a place of secrets then for a very, very long time. But now, what has made writing a book both difficult and interesting is the fact that so many other books and papers have been produced since. Mainly, it's true, by people who are not working in Bletchley themselves. In Bletchley last week, when I launched the book, I drew a distinction between three kinds of people who go to Bletchley now. First of all, there are what they call the veterans, and I am a survivor amongst the veterans. Secondly, there are the volunteers who make it possible to keep Bletchley Park alive and meaningful, and something much more than a museum, a place of living history. And then there are the visitors who go there in very large numbers, most of whom don't remember any war of any magnitude in their own lives at all. Now, when I was at Bletchley, I was very young. In fact, I celebrated my 21st birthday party while I was there. I was only there for 2 years, between July 1943 and July 1945. But since Bletchley ceased to be a secret place, I'm asked more questions about those 2 years in my life than about the rest of my life put together. The questions are interesting ones, many of them. Most people ask me, did I know X or Y at Bletchley? Very difficult question to answer because there were more than 10,000 people working there. It is amazing that I do remember one or two people when I'm asked that question, and I can say, yes, I do remember quite well. The other kind of questions I'm asked are, what part did you play, and what part indeed could a historian play in a place which was full of chess players and mathematicians? I believe myself that Bletchley would not have been successful unless there had been people there like myself who approached it in a very, very different way from mathematicians. What we had to do, and I was a cryptographer, there was a sharp distinction between cryptography and intelligence. What I did as a cryptographer was to try to get into the minds of the people who were sending the messages. Now, historians have got to spend a lot of their lives trying to get into the minds of people who are long since dead. I had to try to get into the minds of people who were Germans, who were very, very much alive. We concentrated, each one of us had one concentration of interest in the hut where I was working. I'll come to the huts in a moment. Mine was Yugoslavia. And it's, of course, a place where so much has happened since the war that I feel I was given a very lucky break in dealing with Yugoslavia. I knew what was going on in the minds of the partisans in Yugoslavia. I knew all the arguments that were going on about Tito and the rest. I found it a most interesting area, but what I would love to be able to have done since the end of the war was actually to meet one of the German Air Force officers who sent the messages that I was involved in breaking. I never met one, unfortunately. In fact, I have not met anybody since the end of the war on the German side who was involved in the sending of the messages which we had to break. Now, it's interesting that when I went to Bletchley, I didn't expect to be there at all to begin with. I was very lucky in 1941 when I took my degree. I was very lucky to be able to have the chance of going into some kind of activity associated with intelligence. And the first thing that I was asked if I would do would be to go into radar. They had the marvellous idea in the war, it couldn't have happened at any other time, that you could turn historians into physicists for the duration of the war. But in order to be accepted for radar, and the fellow in physics in my own college in Cambridge, Sidney Sussex, Ratcliffe, asked me if I would go and join him, but he said that in order to be approved for going there, I would have to go and see C.P. Snow. So on a very dingy Cambridge afternoon in 1941, I went to see C.P. Snow. I did know that he'd written a couple of novels. When I went into his room in Christ College, my first impression was that he was the ugliest man that I'd ever seen in my life. If I'd known what a great man he was going to be, and he'd be involved in all kinds of things with which I was to be involved later on, I would have been rather frightened of this interview, but as it was, he accepted me. So I was accepted into radar, and I was told that I would have to wait and until I got a message from them. So I was placed then in a very curious position. I had to have some money from somewhere. So I went back to my own town and did a certain amount of teaching during the war, which I enjoyed. And I then had a message one week saying, we've got enough people, physicists doing radar, no more historians needed. At that point, I went into the army by the ordinary conventional means. And I didn't go into the intelligence corps even, and I certainly didn't go anywhere near Bletchley. I went quite near to my own home in Yorkshire, to Catterick, and I joined the Royal Corps of Signals. And I was a signalman for 2 years before I joined the intelligence corps. That was a very interesting experience. I enjoyed the Royal Corps of Signals. I even enjoyed Catterick Camp, which many people didn't do. I worked on signals first in relation to learning Morse. We had to sit for a whole day and listen to one Morse letter being played. That would be enough to put one off any Morse for the rest of my life. In fact, it firmly implanted it in my mind. I can even read a Morse message now. But I was quickly moved from Morse in the ordinary sense of the word to interception. And I went down to Trowbridge, where I found myself on an interception course, and I was learning to intercept enemy messages. If I'd been there a bit longer, I would have moved into intercepting Japanese messages, which is extremely difficult. While I was there, little did I know that my wife-to-be, who was at school a few miles away, was there within range of my own camp. I guarded Trowbridge Town Hall while she was on her way to school. Of course, we never met. In fact, it would have been totally improper to have done so. out of my experience in Signals, I was able to give an extra element to Bletchley when I got there, because there were very, very few people in Bletchley who actually, working in cryptography, who had had much contact with Signals before. Or at the time, indeed. I recognised then that Bletchley depended upon a whole elaborate interception service, Y service, and I've tried to pay proper tribute in my book to the Y service, and I'm bound to say that the person who, in my own college, another fellow of my own college, who eventually welcomed me to Bletchley, Gordon Welshman, that he himself recognised the importance of Y service from the start. Now, how did I get to Bletchley? It's all in the book, and I'll deal with it very, very quickly. I was transferred from Signals into the Intelligence Corps, and I went up on the move of the depot of the Intelligence Corps, full of really very intelligent people indeed, some of whom spoke, it seems unbelievable, 40 or 50 different languages. I went up with the Intelligence Corps to their new depot at Wentworth Woodhouse in Yorkshire, and I was there, and I then went on to a field security course. So I might have been involved in field security. And while I was on the field security course, I was asked to go down to report for an interview in Bedford. And I had no idea what I was being interviewed for at all. But when I got there, I realized that I was being interviewed to go onto a cryptography course. A marvellous cryptography course in Bedford. There was, in parallel, a Japanese course. I might well have been put into the Japanese course rather than into the cryptography course, but I wasn't. And I found that in the cryptography course we learned nothing whatsoever that was of any use to me at Bletchley later on. We learned how to do ancient codes and ciphers, the Spanish Armada ciphers and things of that kind, when machines had never been invented. I was with three most interesting people, one of whom, Alexander Levin, became the head of the Russian service of the BBC. He was not allowed to go on from the cryptography course to Bletchley, not because he came from a great Russian family, but because he'd been educated in Trinity College, Dublin, and that was not thought to be a safe place from which to bring people to Bletchley. Alexander, a wonderful character. Alec Hyatt King was head of the music department in the British Museum, and I got on very well with Alec, and long after we kept in touch forever, as it were. And the third person was a man called Monk, who did go on to do Japanese. I was then told, while I was at the course, that I was going to be sent to Bletchley. I was the only one of the group who was. And I got there, unfortunately, I was just in time to be welcomed and received by Gordon Welshman, who wrote a book on which this is a kind of a way, a commentary, called The Hut 6 Story. And he ran Hut 6, and he devised the whole hut system at Bletchley. People were working in separate huts, and they were not supposed to know what was going on in any other hut, except that there was a genuine, regular, daily communication between Hut 6, which dealt with cryptography, and Hut 3, which dealt with intelligence. And I was therefore, from the very, very start of going to Bletchley, involved in a kind of encounter with intelligence and what was going to happen to the messages. And because I was a historian, of course, I really knew rather more about the war and what was going on than most of the mathematicians, and also more than the people who were working with me in Hut 6. It was a most interesting experience to be received by Gordon Welshman, but I wasn't actually given very much information from by him, because he was just about to be transferred to be in charge of the new kinds of mechanical processes which were being evolved to deal with cryptography. Instead, I was welcomed by Brigadier Tiltman, a brilliant cryptographer, a wonderful person, who had been a cryptographer since the 1920s and had broken all kinds of things himself, but was in charge, technically at least, of all the army personnel who were working in various sections of Bletchley. And I've still got a piece of paper which says on it, could you please report and see, it was then Colonel Tiltman, and at some time, please give a call to his secretary. I went in to see Tiltman, and Tiltman said to me, welcome, it's very good that you're here, I've heard a lot about you. I must tell you, however, that you cannot possibly have a commission while you're here at Bletchley, because we can't spare anybody like you at all to go on an octave course. But he said, I'm going to be sure that you'll be at least as well off as you would have been if you'd been given a commission. In fact, you'll be as well off as a captain. So I was promoted from the remarkably low rank of Lance Corporal to Warrant Officer Class 1 at once. And my income was more, indeed, than the captains who were working with me at Bletchley. But there was no distinction of rank in Bletchley Park at all, none. There was a certain distinction of class, social class, no distinction of rank. I thought Tiltman was a great friend. And I'd learned later that one of the people who told him most about me was not Welshman, but my own tutor in Cambridge, who never taught me, my history tutor, Passant, who went into intelligence himself and actually went to Bletchley on day one. He never worked there. He became head of the Foreign Office Intelligence Department, which was, of course, a very privileged place indeed. When I went for my interview in Cambridge as an undergraduate, Passant said to me, I went in 1937, the time of the abdication crisis, and I wrote an essay on the abdication crisis. I have no idea what in the world I said. He said to me at my interview, he said, "Briggs, you're only a baby. But," he said, "there's going to be a war. And I'm determined that you shall be able to take your degree in Cambridge before you put on uniform." And he did it. And it was a wonderful gym, so I owe an enormous debt to him. Inside Bletchley, I try to describe in the book what we did in breaking codes. I've tried to use as the least amount of technical language possible. I found that what we were doing ourselves was essentially trying to guess in an informed way what a German message might, sent in code, might consist of. And this meant really looking very, very carefully at the whole record of messages that had been sent out. We had to work in terms of shifts. We worked from 9 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon, or 4 in the afternoon to midnight, or midnight to 8 o'clock in the morning. If we hadn't broken the main German code, red, Luftwaffe code, by breakfast, we would be in trouble. It was sometimes very difficult to do it at various stages of the war because the Germans changed their machines. But nonetheless, for the most part, we did it. And we did it by preparing what were called cribs. And these cribs consisted of the message, as we saw it, put into the form of a mathematical diagram, a sort of computer program, we then sent it off to machines. By the time I got there, they were in regular use, which were in no sense computers, but were in effect kind of miniature Enigma machines themselves, which were operated entirely in outstations, or almost entirely in outstations from Bletchley, mainly by women, mainly by wrens. One thing that I learned at Bletchley is how important it was to have the services of extremely able women working there during the war. Very clever women indeed, many of them doing dull, repetitive, and awkward jobs. Some of them not even knowing what they were doing, not having been told what they were doing. It was an enlightenment to me, I must say, after being in a university before the war where there were very few women, to find myself with 4 women out of 5 on the staff of the organization. I found myself really working with many people who were working on bombs, as they were called. They were the machines that were invented largely by Turing and Welshman. And they were manufactured not in Bletchley, but in Letchworth. And they were manufactured in what before and after the war was a corset factory in Letchworth. I think we've even got a picture of it in the book. I realized then that a Welshman always said, it's not the bombs that are breaking Enigma, it's you here in Hut 6 who are using the bombs to help you to break Enigma. Now, not everybody at Bletchley was involved in breaking Enigma. It was a very, very kind of wide-ranging institution. There were, for example, 139 people involved in catering. There were about 82 or 3 people involved in transport. And messages were being carried by various forms of transport, and people were being carried by various forms of transport in and out of Bletchley Camp. It's interesting, too, that the disposition of staff was such that the work that was done in the outstations where the Wrens were using the bombs was absolutely essential to our war effort. We were a team organization. We depended upon people of every conceivable range of work. Translators, of course, were fundamentally important. I had an enormous amount to do with Hut 3, which was the intelligence section. That's about all I've got to say, except I'd like just to say a word or two about the title of the book, Secret Days. I put equal weight on the word secret and the word days. We depended in Bletchley on a conception of the day which was not all that common at that time. There was no Today program, for example. Also, we were breaking codes which the Germans changed every day. Thirdly, we were living a life ourselves where we divided up the day. We didn't have time to think of the week or of the year. Secret, I've already spoken about. We had to keep everything secret, not because we signed the Official Secrets Act, but because we knew that if we gave secrets away, we would be giving them away to the enemy. And the enemy never knew that we were breaking the codes. Dönitz, who succeeded Hitler at the end of the war, Admiral Dönitz, was suspicious that we might be breaking the code and had various organizations put in to look at them. And they came to the conclusion that the codes were unbreakable. We ourselves broke them because of the silly mistakes many times that the Germans made themselves. They'd send messages where, for example, they would insert the words Heil Hitler into them or Dies ist ein Abstimmungsruf. This is a nonsense message. And we could really learn their devices in that kind of a way. Without, if they hadn't made mistakes, it would have been much more difficult to have broken it. But Enigma was not the only code or main machine cipher. Even before the war, experiments had been made with using non-Morse non-Morse messages based on teleprinters, which would convey messages without any Morse being used. And in order to deal with those, they had to create a massive machine. And they created the machine called Colossus. That was done with the help of the post office. And in the book, I do pay an immense tribute to the post office, without which we wouldn't have operated at Bletchley. The post office produced the people who helped to make the Colossus machine, which was the world's first digital computer. That was breaking the codes which were sent by teleprinter, which we called FISH, at Bletchley. We loved actually making up names. We had names of animals, birds, colours. When we run out of those, we eventually turned to fishes. And there were several kinds of fish there. I've enjoyed writing this book. It was much more difficult than I ever expected. It is a kind of commentary on other books, as well as a memoir of my own experiences. So when you read it, if you do read it, which I hope you will, you will see that it's a very human account of what went on at Bletchley. I'm not interested in, I think we probably did save about 2 years off the war. But it's a human story, and I'm more interested in that than I am in the exact details of how the machines worked. Thank you very much.
Asa, thank you. I'm going to ask you just one or two questions, and then it will be open to all, and we have microphones at the front, and we've got roving microphones behind. And I'm going to start right at the beginning. And you dedicate the book to Susan, your wife. And you say on the front page, "For Susan, to whom all," in italics, "is now revealed." Now, two questions. Is that true? And secondly, are there still some Bletchley secrets that perhaps you don't even know about?
There are secrets still. And, of course, I don't know what they all are, because they wouldn't be secrets if I did know what they are. but there were some secrets which I do know have not been revealed. For example, there's a technical history written of... at the end of the war, histories were produced, and I've been able to use all the documents in the Public Record Office, which are relevant. Very, very difficult job. But there's one history of Hut 6 which was written, the technical side of Hut 6, that's never been published. There's no sign whenever it might. Also, I know that the diplomatic messages which were being broken, and they've not been revealed. All I can say, I've revealed to Susan all that she's ever asked me, I think. And that's a better way of putting it.
One of the... I think what people might be interested, perhaps, is just one or two pointers as to how Bletchley really contributed to reducing loss of life and to shortening the war. I mean, you said it's been estimated that it reduced the war by about 2 years. What do you see as two or three nodal points where Bletchley really made a difference?
Well, the most important thing was eventually helping to deal with U-boats. That was the biggest contribution. That was not done by my own bit of Bletchley. It was done by in Hut 8, which was concerned with naval cryptography. I did know all the people in Hut 8 quite well. We worked on very close terms with them. We were both sharing the bombs, and we had to reach agreement about that. So I think the most important aspect, probably, of the Bletchley during the war was its eventual success in helping us to destroy U-boats. The second thing that it helped us with was in having very full information about the North African campaign. I was there not in time really to see the full story of most of these early bits of Bletchley work through. The third thing was that it helped us immensely, complemented by deception techniques in relation to D-Day and thereafter, and the move into Germany. The one time I got very worried at Bletchley was during the Ardennes offensive at the end of the war, when it was a bold gamble on the part of Hitler, which his generals didn't much like. And I was a bit frightened that they were doing much better in the Ardennes offensive than the newspapers said or than I thought. So that was my... But they were their examples of real contributions to the war effort.
You said to us at the university on Monday that you were really interested in human history, and you've said that again today. It's the people that you're interested in. One of the characters that really comes out from this book, and indeed other books on Bletchley, is the story, the tragic story of Alan Turing. And I just wonder whether you could say one or two words about him as a person. Next year, 2012, we're going to celebrate the centenary of his birth. And some of you may well remember that in 1998, Gordon Brown actually apologised nationally for the way in which Turing had been treated in the early 50s. Thoughts, Asa?
Well, I met Turing once or twice. Didn't know him really properly. He was not working in Bletchley for most of the time that I was there. He, curiously enough, was working very happily with the post office. Turing was a genuine eccentric, and there was no shortage of eccentrics at Bletchley. Some of them pretended to be eccentrics when they weren't. But there was no doubt that Turing genuinely was. When the novel Enigma was published, it gets Turing, I think, slightly wrong, but it's a good novel for catching aspects of Bletchley. Turing, for example, felt that it was dangerous to keep his coins in wartime currency, so he bought pieces of silver and put them underneath the ground in various parts of Bletchley Park, and then he forgot where he put them. And they're still there under the ground somewhere. People having a jolly good try with modern equipment to find them, but they failed to do so. He also used to go to work wearing a gas mask as he went to work on his bicycle. He was a great bicyclist. He was also, he did it because, in fact, he thought that his asthma, there was a rationality behind a good deal of Turing's eccentricity. I didn't know anything during the war about his homosexuality, but others did. And it's interesting now that a memorial to him in Manchester, where the gay parade walks past the monument every year, there's a monument to him in Bletchley, and there's a monument to him in his old school, Sherburn, where he went. He was a brilliant mathematician. Indeed, I'd go so far as to say that he was a real genius.
And probably, if there was one person singled out, the brain behind Colossus. Is that true?
No. Turing played a very big part. The man who was the real brain behind Colossus was a post office man called Flowers. And they've now reconstructed Colossus at Bletchley, which you can see. And Sale, Tony Sale, is the person who's reconstructed. It is a most remarkable machine to see. Even now, it employed enormous numbers of valves, and people thought that it was quite impossible that anything using so many valves, and valves were a relatively new invention, anything employing so many valves couldn't conceivably work.
Questions from the audience. I see a hand at the back, yes.
Hello. Hello, Lord Briggs, thank you very much for the talk. The first thing I'd like to do is admit a personal connection here. I'm Alec Hyatt King's grandson, and I'd like to thank you for your kind comments about him. The second thing is a question a bit one removed perhaps from Bletchley, and it's to do with what were the Germans doing in relation to British and Allied codes. I've read a fair bit about Bletchley Park, and there's very rarely much mention about what the other side was doing, and I can't really seem to find many books in the English language about it. I was wondering if you knew anything about that.
I didn't quite catch the
question. While we were cracking German codes, what were the Germans doing? And I guess the subtext is, were they aware of what we were doing, and were they accommodating or adapting to what we were doing? Is that a fair summary?
They had no idea that we were breaking Enigma. They probably had some idea that we were managing to break fish. They themselves were breaking, and it was of tremendous importance, they were breaking the private messages that were sent from Churchill to Roosevelt. They were not, however, as far as I'm aware, breaking any of our army codes, or indeed Air Force codes. They were, for example, handicapped by the fact that they didn't know precisely what was passing between Eisenhower, Montgomery, and the generals in chief at the end of the war.
Other questions? Please wave your hand, because you're a little... Yes, I can see a hand at the middle of the back in the tiered section. We do have microphones down here at the front, I believe, so please feel free to come to those microphones if you wish to ask a question.
Lord Briggs, you mentioned the human dimension, and one of the photographs on the screen before you came in was of a young man called Harry Hinsley, and it said, the brilliant young man from Walsall. Why was he on the screen, and why was he regarded as brilliant?
Harry Hinsley.
Yes, yes. Harry was a very remarkable man indeed, because he wrote the official history of intelligence during the war. He was more or less a contemporary of mine. He came from Walsall. He went to into the naval part of Bletchley at the start, and he was so clever at dealing with messages that, in fact, at a very early age indeed, he was taken into the confidence of the Admiralty. At first, he had to have a kind of a struggle to some extent with naval intelligence, because the Navy had been so actively involved in the running of all intelligence at one time. He's a very interesting person. I didn't know him very well at Bletchley. I did know him a little. I knew him very well after the end of the war, when he became the head of St. John's College in Cambridge. I don't think Harry and I ever had any discussion whatsoever on Bletchley in my life. We were pretty careful, actually, until the 1970s and 80s, of even talking to people we knew who had been important at Bletchley and whom we knew personally. I don't myself like official histories. I should say that at once. I'm suspicious of them. I was taught that by A.G.P. Taylor, and I've never lost my suspicions. But during the war, I did feel that Hinsley was acquiring the kind of experience that made him as suitable a person for writing an official history, if one was going to be written, as you could find. But if there was going to be an official history at the end of the war, I felt it should be done by a non-Bletchley insider. I never was prepared even to review a book on Bletchley until the 1990s. And there were a lot of people who felt like me. And I did know that Winterbourne, who wrote the first book, which broke the taboos, made so many mistakes in his book and didn't know anything really about Enigma or the bombs that he was given official permission to do it, write his book. I felt that Winterbourne broke taboos, which was most important, but he didn't really provide an account which was reliable. Welshman thought that Hinsley's account in the official history was in many places unreliable. But it, nonetheless, it would be foolish to say, not to say, that the official history is a very remarkable piece of work.
Simon.
Asa, how do you break a code? Where do you start? And what are the steps that you then go through? And when are you satisfied that you've reached a conclusion?
How do you break a code? Well, first of all, you realise that you've got to get messages of a certain length. You can't break a code normally, a cipher, in terms of if it's too short. You know sometimes that the same message is sent every day. Weather messages, for example. And you use your knowledge of what had been happened. Once you've got into the breaking, you use your knowledge on the basis of that kind of repetition. You also know that a message sent in one code, one key, codes are divided up into keys. One key message might be just transmitted in terms in another key. And if you can break one, you can break two. You break them by picking out parts of a message which you think you can understand. The machine itself had one quality which made this possible. It could never reproduce the same letter in the encrypted message as was there in the original. You could never use the same letter. Therefore, we could look for places, we could decide how to get into a code, cipher, very frequently, by recognizing that possibility of the machine. Then, as I've said earlier, the Germans themselves made mistakes which made it possible. For example, they had an obsession with rank, and they would want to put in the beginning of the message the name of the person, his full rank, and so on. And then, as I said, they might throw in Heil Hitler as well, and even a little bit of propaganda into the message. So that... you broke them on the basis of imagination, I think, on the basis of understanding of the mentalities of the senders. You didn't really break them at all. The bomb was mathematically devised. But you didn't really need a mathematician to break them unless the code itself, or the machinery behind the German use of the code, had itself changed. And when it did change, and it caused us endless trouble in February 1945, towards the end of the war, when they changed the machine, then you didn't really need a mathematician too much to be involved. We did have mathematicians always in the background who knew all about the machines, and some of them were marvellous. and I envied them.
You were decoding encrypted German. How important was the knowledge of German to break the code?
It was quite useful, but it was it was military German.
Simple.
When peasants advised to me when I got my scholarship was learn German before you come. And I did, and I found that my German isn't particularly good, but I could understand military German very well. I could talk about Panzer Corps and all the kind of German military stuff, which many people who had read German at university didn't know anything about at all. But nonetheless, Bletchley depended upon excellent translators, and there were many of them there, and without them it couldn't have operated at all.
Michael, can you look to your left, please?
I beg your pardon.
Thank you. Thanks. Lord Briggs, do you know why they named it bomb, especially with the French spelling?
With the Letchworth?
With the E at the end. Why did they choose the word bomb?
Yes. Because the Poles, I haven't had time to say anything about that. There's something in the book. There's a kind of Polish prelude to the Bletchley story because the Poles broke Enigma. It's true, a rather different kind of Enigma before the war. And they were a wonderful group of people, and they provided us with Enigma machines at the beginning of the war, or the French, and one of the machines made its way to England and could be played with here. They developed a machine which they called a bomba. And the word bomb derives from that.
Oh, thank you.
Jeff.
Hey, sir. How positively did your wartime experience at Bletchley contribute to your future career as a historian and university manager?
Contribute to my
future career?
Teacher career. Oh, immensely. I think, first of all, I learnt in Bletchley the importance of teamwork. Even brilliant individuals and people who were far from brilliant working together. People of very different abilities working together. They gave me a kind of feeling of the importance of what I subsequently began to call interdisciplinarity. I realized you couldn't really depend upon mathematicians alone. You needed mathematicians, historians. The one group of people I was surprised that there were not more of at Bletchley, as I've said in the book, and I'm still surprised, were psychologists. Mm. There was one psychologist who was in intelligence in Hut 3, who was quite important, a man called Ozer, who subsequently went out to Australia. But I learned that aspect of it. I also learned from Bletchley the importance of trying to get rid of too elaborate a hierarchy of ranks in a university. I mean, I've never believed very strongly in anything other than as far as you can get to a sort of equality of respect and esteem across all divides. And I found that when I went to Oxford after the end of the war, the place that was most like Bletchley to me was the Institute of Statistics, curiously enough, in Oxford, where economists of different kinds and statisticians and so on all worked together on equal terms without raising any questions of rank at all.
Asa, you mentioned the Robert Harris book, Enigma,
yes,
which obviously became a very successful film. He suggests that there was a spy at Bletchley Park. John Carecross, one of the Cambridge yes. Five, was certainly at Bletchley in the early 40s. Were there spies in Bletchley?
Apparently not, except for Carecross. And Carecross was not providing information for the Germans, but for the Russians. And curiously enough, we were supplying a fair amount of that information ourselves. But Stalin didn't very much trust the information that was supplied him through Bletchley channels, and his trusted Cairncross's information much more. And also, Cairncross produced a prodigious amount of information. As far as I know, there was no other spy, and certainly no German spy, in Bletchley. If there had been, it would have altered the whole picture.
We're coming towards the end, but I've got one or two very quick questions. Page 124 of your book, and we're towards the end of the war. It's called The End of the War, this chapter. And you say, I was also working in the watch on Monday, 7 May, happens to be his birthday, when I received and passed on to Hut 3 a message in clear from Grand Admiral Dönitz, Commander-in-Chief of the German Navy and Hitler's successor, saying that Germany had surrendered unconditionally.
Yes, it was quite remarkable. I've described the division of labour in Hut 6 watch. We used to, one of us sat at a conveyor belt where the messages were coming in. One of us was the duty officer for the day and was in charge of the link-ups with the bombs. One of us was keeping a daily log. Very few messages came over in clear. There were some throughout the whole of the war, but very few in my time came in clear until the end of the war. I did know a bit about Dönitz's mind. I was interested in Dönitz and still am. But to get a message in clear was tremendous, saying the war is over. That was most important of all, of course. But then, of course, my birthday got confused with the end of the war and with V-Day. And I was never quite sure whether I was celebrating the end of the war, of the European war, or my birthday. And they got confused.
And I've got one final, very serious question, Reza. In the slides that we showed before you came on, there was a wonderful picture taken by yourself in the garden of a country pub, the three rather charming women.
Yes.
Now, was Bletchley a hot place for romance?
Certainly. Certainly. The Americans, I did get to know the Americans very well. And we all got on very well with them. And I used to go to the American camp a lot. And there I learned to drink American coffee, tomato juice, eat avocados for the first time, and also for the first time to have a glass of bourbon on the rocks. They were very much more privileged in terms of food than we were. I was even offered an occasional banana. The question was, of course, can you just put it again, if you will, Michael?
Did people walk out
together? The romances, yes.
Did they court? Were there any marriages? Were there any Bletchley children?
There were a lot of marriages.
Were there?
There were, as far as I'm aware, there were not many Bletchley children. But there were plenty of romances. I went to one or two weddings. I went to one American wedding after the end of the war. Of an American person working with me in Hut 6, a songwriter and a rather charming English girl.
Well, I think we're timed out. And I think it just leaves me, Asa, to thank you on behalf of all of us for, I think, a spectacular hour. I think you've given us a real glimpse of Bletchley Park, the activities therein, its contribution to perhaps bringing conflict to an end earlier than it might have done. And you've given us a wonderful human flavour of the people that were there. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.